Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how to significantly reduce the number of Americans killed by guns every year without touching Second Amendment rights. We'll spend this hour with Frederick Vars, who proposes a series of bottom-up measures to reduce firearm violence, including some that make it easier to know who has a gun and choose not to live near that person, and others that allow people to exclude themselves from the ability to purchase a deadly weapon at times when they're experiencing a mental health crisis. We'll talk about the role markets might play in people's decisions of whether to carry weapons and about the pros and cons of privatized gun-free zones. Our conversation starts after a short break. Horrifying spectacle of mass shootings, the wall-to-wall TV coverage, and our identification with victims who were just in the wrong place at the wrong time makes us wish we could end gun violence. We're sincere when we demand solutions, but then we start fighting about the Second Amendment and nothing really changes. Maybe our problem is where we focus our energy around firearm violence, because while mass shootings take 300 or 400 lives a year, which is terrible, gun suicides take more than 24,000, and we might save at least some of those who die by their own hand with bottom-up measures that leave Second Amendment rights intact. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Frederick E. Vars is the Ira Drayton Pruitt Senior Professor of Law at the University of Alabama, where he specializes in mental health law, and a member of the American Bar Association Standing Committee on Gun Violence. His book, Weapon of Choice, Fighting Gun Violence While Respecting Gun Rights, is co-authored by Ian Ayers, and it proposes ways we might keep more people and places free of guns on a voluntary basis. Fred, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the ideas you share in this book are about strategies for gun control that enhance rather than remove choices from people. Traditional gun control is really about kind of top-down government restrictions on who can have a firearm. How does a bottom-up approach even work?
Sure. Well, the centerpiece proposal is really the best illustration of this. It's called Donna's Law, and it's named after a woman, Donna Nathan, who in New Orleans took her own life tragically with a gun she purchased the same day, shortly after a voluntary hospitalization for suicidal thinking and bipolar disorder. And she sort of tragically lost her life in the struggle against suicide and suicidal thinking, and really had no way to protect herself against making an impulsive decision to go out and purchase that gun. So her daughter, Katrina Breeze, has become an ally of Ian and mine in proposing Donna's Law, which would allow people like Donna or even just others who don't want access to guns to sign up, put their name on a confidential list that would prevent themselves from purchasing a gun in the throes of a suicidal episode.
So it's interesting that you note that it was a voluntary hospitalization in the days before her life ended. It suggests that at times when Donna Nathan was more healthy, and she did have periods of good mental health in her life, had this law been in existence, she might have chosen to self-restrict her ability to buy a gun when she was not healthy, kind of like an advance directive?
That's absolutely the idea. And her daughter, Katrina Breeze, strongly believes that her mother would have taken advantage of the law and self-restricted her access to firearms. The other thing to note, and I think your analogy to an advance directive is a great one. You know, we allow people to, in advance of having a debilitating medical condition, to say what kind of treatment they either want or do not want. And then when they're unable to make a decision, those treatment decisions they made in advance can be put into effect with an advance directive. So this is really just the same idea. The other thing that's significant to note, that Donna Nathan's psychiatric hospitalizations were voluntary, is that that meant she wasn't prohibited from purchasing a gun. In this country, if you are involuntarily hospitalized, and records are kept and transferred as they should be, which is not always the case, but an involuntary hospitalization actually takes away your ability to legally purchase a firearm.
So you've thought about this topic as a law professor because you care about making changes that could make Americans demonstrably safer without taking rights away from lawful, responsible gun owners. It's also personal to you, and you write about this in the preface to the book. Will you talk about that?
Absolutely. So I have bipolar disorder. I have dealt with periods of suicidal thinking, have never made an attempt, but have been to the point where I've actually had a plan and a sort of method selected. So when I first had the idea for Donna's Law, I knew instantly that it would be something that I would want to sign up for. And I think people, you know, as you mentioned, Donna Nathan is not alone. Most people with mental health issues have periods of lucidity, periods of relatively good health. They're taking steps and trying to take care of themselves. This is just another way for people to take care of themselves. And so for me personally, you know, it's very attractive because I actually want to sign up, but it's also a way in which, you know, the times I have suffered, I think, could actually be turned into something positive and something, you know, life-saving. Because people with mental illness are very often in the conversation about mass shootings and so forth. But, you know, as you mentioned in the beginning, almost two-thirds of gun deaths are suicides. You know, people with mental health have agency and have a desire to live and a desire to get better and to take care of themselves. And so when we, you know, I had the idea and got some co-authors together and administered a survey and actually found among a sample of 200 people receiving psychiatric care, both inpatient and outpatient, 46% said they would sign up for Donna's Law. And so that number is really what motivated me to move into advocacy and promoting the idea in state legislatures across the country.
It can be easy to get the impression that Americans who currently own guns are vehemently opposed to gun restrictions in any form. Is that actually true?
No, that's absolutely not true. There are many different gun regulations that gun owners support. Donna's Law is just one example. And we actually, Ian and I, my co-author in the book, Ian Ayers, did a survey asking people, you know, first, would you sign up for Donna's Law? And we found nearly a third of people in the general population said they would. But then also more pointedly, would you support the proposal? You know, even if you didn't want yourself personally to sign up, do you support the idea? And we found strong majorities of gun owners, veterans, Republicans. So it can really cut across political divides. And because I think, you know, you hit on the key point at the outset, it's voluntary. Right. You know, if you're a gun owner, obviously don't sign up. But if there are other people who want to, you know, decided they don't want guns, that they aren't safe with guns, then why prevent them from having that choice? If you believe in liberty, you should believe in this choice for other people.
So if you use something like Donna's Law to self-restrict when one is healthy, is it revocable? If you decide you want to go dove hunting with your brother-in-law when you are healthy, are you able to reverse the restrictions placed on you with someone like something like Donna's Law?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I mentioned there are a couple different versions of Donna's Law that have actually been enacted. So Washington State was the first state to enact a version. There, if you just make a request after 7 days of being on the list, your name will be taken off. So it's absolutely reversible. In Virginia, which is the second state to adopt, there's a bit more of a delay period, which I actually am a big advocate for. So you can make a request to have your name removed from the prohibited list, but there's a 21-day delay before your name is actually removed. And for someone who's experienced a suicidal period, those are temporary for most people, vast majority of people, and don't persist longer than 21 days. So having that additional cushion Maybe it delays your hunting trip for 3 weeks, or you've got to, do a little advanced planning to get back your right to purchase a gun for that. But for someone who's going through a tough patch, usually just that delay period is enough for people to change their mind and say, "Look, I don't want to kill myself." And that's something about suicide. So in advocating for the law, I've encountered all sorts of misconceptions and kind of myths about suicide. But an important one is that when people decide to attempt suicide, the myth is that they've made this permanent decision. They'll find a way no matter what. And if you prevent one attempt, well, eventually they'll succeed and kill themselves. So those things just aren't true. If you take away the most lethal common method, namely a firearm, the vast majority of people survive that suicide attempt. And then the second piece of that is people change their mind. So only 10% of people, roughly, after a serious suicide attempt, go on to actually die by suicide, to keep trying until they attempt suicide. 90% of people don't. So if you take the gun away from one suicide attempt and an individual survives, chances are, overwhelmingly, the chances are they'll go on and live out the rest of their lives and not die by suicide.
What else could be added to versions of Donna's Law to notify other people that someone has invoked the law to waive their Second Amendment rights?
Yeah, so we talk about this in the second section of the book, and sort of enhancing people's associational preferences, or empowering people to associate based on their decisions regarding gun ownership. So the current situation, there's a kind of an asymmetry. If you want to demonstrate to your neighbor that you own a gun, you can simply show them your gun. But if you want to tell your neighbor, "I'm not a gun owner," how do you show that, right? I mean, the fact that you're not holding a gun at that moment, that says something, but it doesn't say that the gun isn't somewhere else in the house, right? So if you can show your neighbor or your landlord or, someone else you're in a close relationship with, that, "Look, I've signed up for Donna's Law. I've sort of pledged to be gun free," then, maybe the neighbor says, "Okay, well, now I trust you enough that I can send my kid over for a play date." Or the landlord says, "Look, I'm going to rent to you because I don't have to worry when I come around knocking on your door asking for late rent that you have a gun in the house," right? So it's empowering that kind of, and that's a sort of add-on to Donna's Law. And this is honestly the most controversial part of the book. And the most important thing that, I've been pushing, this is not a feature in Washington or Virginia or the other states that have introduced versions of Donna's Law. But this, you asked about potential extension. This is one. And it would close that sort of asymmetry. So you can show, not just that you own a gun, but you can show more credibly that you don't, and you've decided, to be gun free in your house. So that's the idea of the associational preference option.
And that wouldn't be limited to people who had self-restricted for health reasons. It could be anyone who decided, for whatever reason, they don't want to own a firearm.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's something to make critical. It's critically important, and we've seen actually a couple bills introduced in states that would limit Donna's Law to people with mental health problems. And Ian and I, and the others who've been working on this bill across states, think that's absolutely a mistake. It should be open to anyone. And you may have an anger problem or an alcohol problem or going through a rough patch in a relationship, and depressed for that reason. There's no reason to limit Donna's Law to people with mental health problems. People without mental health problems also attempt suicide, or perpetrate gun violence. So, absolutely, it should be open to everyone.
My guest is Frederick E. Vars. He is professor of law at the University of Alabama, specializing in mental health law, and he's co-author of Weapon of Choice: Fighting Gun Violence While Respecting Gun Rights. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frederick E. Vars, who is Ira Drayton Pruitt Senior Professor of Law at the University of Alabama, specializing in mental health law, and co-author of the book Weapon of Choice, Fighting Gun Violence While Respecting Gun Rights. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or on Twitter at KERA Think. All right, Fred, we talk a lot about the Second Amendment and our right to keep guns. Does anything in the Constitution give me the right, explicitly or implicitly, not to get shot?
That's a great question. I think when you talk about liberty in the context of guns, it is important to keep in mind that there's liberty on both sides of the equation. There is your liberty interest and, you know, specific in the Constitution, the Second Amendment right to bear arms. But on the other hand, people have a right not to get shot. That right is, you know, obviously harder to enforce. You know, the state does things. They we have police and so forth to try to protect your right to life. Certainly in the context of the way the Second Amendment gets bandied about, it's this sort of absolute right to bear arms without really considering the consequence. Or the sort of, right on the other side to be free from gun violence. I think the right is there, but it's certainly underappreciated.
So what does it take for a business or some other place that is generally understood to be open to the public to declare itself a gun-free zone?
So in most jurisdictions, the store is going to have to post signs, you know, no firearms allowed. And in some places, even that's not allowed, that a person with a concealed carry permit is, even if the owner would rather there be no firearms, doesn't have that option. And that's something, you know, we talked about the associational extension of Donna's Law, but the idea of a private gun-free zone is a broader one. And I think you're right to identify that issue as a separate one. You know, you see these signs in rural areas posted, no trespassing. Well, that's because the default in those areas is that a perfect stranger can bring their hunting rifle onto your land. We think that shouldn't be the default. The default should be, look, that's trespassing. There isn't a sort of unbridled right to hunt on everyone else's land. Landowners should have this kind of control over who can carry a gun to hunt or to go shopping or to be in, in the landowner's private property.
What about private homes? Like, what right do I have to ask that, say, a plumber who comes to my house to do repairs does not bring in a weapon without my permission?
You just have to ask. You just have to make it explicit. But again, in most places, almost every state, the default is that person you invite onto your land can bring a gun. And you have to expressly tell them that they can't. And again, we think that would surprise many. You know, not every part of the country is the same. You know, I live in Alabama, and maybe the idea that the repairman can bring a gun onto your property is something we should all kind of expect here. But I think in most parts of the country, people might be surprised to know just saying, sure, you can come on my land, is implicitly saying you can bring a gun. And you have to, you know, make that express statement to the contrary to actually prevent someone from bringing a gun onto your land.
Doesn't it feel like it should be the other way around?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the default should be, look, you can't bring a gun onto someone else's land unless you get permission, right? And that to me makes a great deal more sense.
Okay, so how can we honor Second Amendment rights to own firearms and also protect the rights of people not to be harmed by guns, especially if they choose not to own guns themselves?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, the proposals in the book try to avoid the Second Amendment more or less completely. And when we were talking about Donna's Law, it's voluntary. You know, as I was mentioning, if you're a gun owner, it just doesn't affect you. So it really impinges no one's right to bear arms because it's just everyone's individual choice not to bear arms. And the other proposals in the book are, I would say, relatively modest. You know, some of them will harness information from other people to take away someone's gun rights, you know, and look a little more top-down regulatory, but they're modest and they're based on sort of indicia of danger and harm, and they aren't just a blanket ban on assault weapons or ban on certain types of ammunition or a certain category of people because of who they are, as opposed to what kind of, you know, symptoms they might be experiencing or other sort of danger, specific danger they might be presenting. So it's in those areas where we think that the individual interest in protection and safety is the strongest, when the government can actually, or, you know, private citizens can say, look, I'm at risk. Or, look, I know my neighbor is suffering from paranoid delusions, right? That's the kind of person who shouldn't have a gun. Not some across the board, oh, you know, this person happens to be, you know, say a marijuana user and therefore shouldn't be able to have a gun, right? We're not pushing that kind of gun control.
Are landlords in most states allowed to forbid people from keeping weapons on the property owned by the landlord but rented by the tenant?
So I think that's true in most states. That's my understanding.
Okay, so if landlords were to declare a policy that said, you know, I don't want to rent to people who have a gun, would there be a Second Amendment conflict there? Because I mean, you live in a place voluntarily. On the other hand, everyone has to live somewhere.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And that there's something. The issue really is, are there other places you can live, right? I mean, if you had every landlord in a city saying, we're all going to have gun-free apartment buildings, and there are simply no other affordable places to live in a city, then that might start getting into, it looks like essentially a zoning law. You know, I mean, it looks like government regulation, even though it's a bunch of private decision makers. So, but as long as there are other opportunities and other places for people to live, we think the landlord should have that freedom to decide, look, I want a gun-free apartment complex. And so that's where we come down. But I think you're right. At some point, and this is in law, this is sometimes referred to as the company town doctrine, right? In the old days, if the mining company owned everything in the town and said, oh, it's a gun-free town, well, that starts looking like, you know, a government has done it. But if you're in a town where there's more than one company and not every one of them is making the same, you know, cost benefit decision regarding guns, well, then you still have options and your freedom has been limited in some way, but not eliminated.
What about neighborhood associations and HOAs? I can make a deal with someone to purchase their house for the agreed upon price and then find myself moving into a neighborhood where there's some kind of local compact not to have weapons.
Great. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And we think that those you know, covenants and restrictions in an HOA are enforceable. A no gun covenant absolutely could be enforceable. And you know, importantly, people who move into those communities have a chance to read the restrictions before they choose to purchase. So it really is, and whether this gets to be too great of a restriction on the Second Amendment hinges on the same issue as we were talking about with landlords, right? If there's somewhere else you can live that doesn't have that restriction on firearms, well, then the choice of the people who live here to be, you know, like-minded, and maybe they want their kids to be able to have play dates without worrying about, you know, is the neighbors, are the guns properly secured, right? They just want to say, look, we're in a gun-free neighborhood, and they want that choice. As long as there are adequate places for people with guns to live, outside of that HOA, that's individual choice.
So this is not a legal question so much as a practical one. Is there any reason to expect that a neighborhood that publicly declares itself a gun-free zone will become a really tempting target for criminals who know that, like, if they're caught, say, breaking into a home, they're not going to be shot?
Right. Well, that is definitely has been part of the argument, with like gun-free zones for schools, right? Because there has already been, federal legislation. You can't have a firearm within 500 feet, 1,000 feet of a school. And people have certainly argued that this makes schools more vulnerable targets. And I don't know the literature on that very well, but my sense is that, first, it's just a very contentious area. Some people claim to have found evidence that gun-free zones are more likely to be targeted. Other people have said, wait, controlling for everything else, we don't really find strong evidence of that. So I haven't seen a real, I think the jury's out on what the real impact is. But, certainly there is an intuition there that if you're going to rob a house, you'd rather rob the house where the owner doesn't have a gun.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 800-933-5372. Jeff is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. So I just had a couple of questions. I wanted to make clear early on, as I did to the call screener, I'm also an attorney. I'm a veteran. I'm a gun owner. I'm a libertarian. And I certainly appreciate the, effort that's being taken to look at this issue from something in a way that doesn't infringe on Second Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. That being said, I have a couple of questions. I guess the first is, with respect to people that didn't have mental issues and voluntarily signed up for something like Donna's Law, would they be able to opt into a shorter period in order to get off of that list? And second, as a libertarian, I certainly appreciate the respect for owners, landowners, property rights, exempting from your property certain individuals. But from kind of the anti-gun side, which is typically the left, is that not inconsistent with landowners' rights to do any number of things and exclude people from their businesses? To say you can go to this other place for a business within the city. You can rent from another landlord in the city based on any number of factors or qualifications of that individual.
Well, Jeff, those are great questions. I really appreciate you calling. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, Fred, do you have responses to those questions?
Sure. So taking up the second one, I think I basically agree. I mean, as a property owner, you ought to be able to make the decision. And the question is really just about the default. Right? Whether you've got to go out of your way to post a sign saying, don't bring your firearm onto my land, or whether the person who wants to come onto your land has to say, look, I'd like to bring my firearm. Do I get permission? Right? So it's not really affecting the amount of liberty. It's just making clear that the choice needs to be expressed and that the default is not guns in every location. Right, and including private locations. The first one about the Second Amendment, the length of the delay period for Donna's Law, 21 days is the law in Virginia. Again, as I mentioned, in Washington State, you can get back your gun rights more quickly. There's a 7-day period after you first sign up that you can't get your rights restored. But after those 7 days passed, you can get your rights restored almost immediately. And I should mention, Donna's Law is very much in play. There are bills introduced currently. I've actually been working. I know that the show is out of Dallas. I think the caller said he was from Dallas as well. I've been working with Senator Johnson on a version of Donna's Law for Texas. And the delay period, it doesn't depend on whether or not you have a mental health condition. And I would hate for the law to draw any distinction based on whether or not you have a mental health condition. I think that's potentially stigmatizing and would discourage people from signing up. But the length of the delay period is very much in play. And my recollection of the last version of the bill in Texas was that it was maybe a 5-day or 7-day delay to get back your gun rights, which, you know, again, maybe striking a balance that, you know, is more toward the Second Amendment position of kind of easy or easier access to gun rights while still providing a significant cushion and sort of cooling off period for people who may have suicidal intent.
Okay, let's go next on the phone to Steve in Carrollton, Texas. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Now, I think this question is interesting about the default position because we certainly have a constitutional right to keep and bear arms. But to make it the default position that you can't do that is rather interesting because someone could walk onto your property with a book of matches and set your property on fire. They could take a chainsaw in and cut your trees down. I mean, they could do any number of things with things. So at what point do we say, you know, something is not a default? You have a right to own something lawfully, but you don't have the right to injure someone with it. That I mean, you could say the same thing about cars and drunk driving, vehicular homicide, those sorts of things.
What do you think about that, Fred?
I think that's a terrific point, and I think it depends on sort of how dangerous the object is and what we think the preferences of your sort of typical property owner is with respect to a book of matches versus a concealed handgun versus an obviously not concealed chainsaw, you know, so that, you know, and I think my sense, and you know, this wouldn't be a totally radical proposition. There are a few states where the default is you have to ask permission to bring your gun onto somebody else's land. So some states, I think it's, I'll get the states wrong if I guess, but in any event, there are a couple states where that's already the default. And so shifting it in other states, I think does accord with the kind of common sense understanding of a lot of property owners.
My guest is Frederick E. Vars, professor of law at the University of Alabama and co-author of Weapon of Choice, Fighting Gun Violence While Respecting Gun Rights. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frederick E. Vars, who is Ira Drayton Pruitt Senior Professor of Law at the University of Alabama, specializing in mental health law. His new book is called Weapon of Choice, Fighting Gun Violence While Respecting Gun Rights. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org. All right, Fred, I want to talk about so-called red flag laws. These don't exist everywhere. They are relatively new. So will you just give us a quick explanation of how these laws broadly are supposed to work?
Absolutely. So red flag laws, I think we're up to 20 states, maybe including the District of Columbia, that have red flag laws. And basically, you have to make an individualized showing that a person is kind of an imminent threat of misusing a firearm. And if you can show, convince a judge that that's the case, then the person's guns can be confiscated, their name can be put onto, you know, the do not buy list so that they're unable to legally purchase a firearm. The controversy with respect to with respect to red flag laws centers around due process. You know, whether if a police officer calls a magistrate and says, we think this person's dangerous, should that be a sufficient basis to immediately take away guns? Now, every state, I think, that has a red flag law has a process after the fact that says, you know, within 30 days, 14 days, it varies. There has to be a hearing where the individual can come in and say, look, I'm feeling fine. I'm taking my medication. I'm, you know, I was angry then, but I'm okay now. I'm not a threat with firearms and can get back the confiscated weapons along with their ability to purchase.
Yeah, I know some people are spooked by red flag laws because they're protective of Second Amendment rights, and they worry that, like, any diagnosis of mental illness might deprive them of their rights when their particular illness might not carry any particular risk of self-harm or harm to other people. Are there ways to refine red flag laws and the symptoms that trigger those laws rather than revoking them?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, in our book, we don't really take a position on existing red flag laws, although I think I can speak for Ian. We're generally in favor of the red flag laws, or the concept, at least, of red flag laws, whether the process being provided is sufficient. What we propose in the book is a kind of supplement to red flag laws and saying, look, instead of just saying globally, is this person dangerous, let's find specific symptoms that have been demonstrated to correlate with danger. And in particular, we identify paranoid delusions and threatening hallucinations. People who believe someone's out to get them probably shouldn't have a gun, right? And so that kind of layer and that kind of more objective trigger for a red flag order, we think would be really helpful.
So many times people talk about the need to enforce the gun laws already on the books rather than creating new ones, no matter how well intentioned. You note here that 20% of Americans are disqualified from owning firearms for one reason or another right now, but that, you know, many of these disqualified people have guns anyway. First of all, is there evidence that we are somehow too strict in declaring large categories of people ineligible to own guns due to particular crimes they've committed or some other reason?
Yeah, so personally, I think we probably are too strict, you know, and I mentioned the category of, you know, a recreational cannabis user, someone who, you know, smokes marijuana on the weekend, is technically prohibited from possessing a firearm in this country under federal law. You know, recreational cannabis use is not associated with a danger of misusing a firearm. So I think that the federal law is overbroad. And this is a separate area where we're kind of tweaking or supplementing red flag laws. Our proposal is to have a separate petition process that says, look, this person is already disqualified for what we think may be a good reason, like they have a real alcohol problem, as demonstrated by two or three, you know, DUIs. So that person really shouldn't have a gun. And if you can use that kind of objective trigger, you can take away someone's guns and their ability to purchase guns. So I'd say it is, in some ways, it is a way to enforce existing gun laws, but we wouldn't necessarily enforce them to the full extent of existing gun laws. But we think gun law has identified some people who really are a greater threat to misuse firearms. And rather than a kind of honor system, where if you're convicted of a felony, you're supposed to come bring in your guns, we should actually have a mechanism to remove the guns.
What are some ways that we could improve the national instant background check system?
Well, first of all, just better reporting. I mean, this has been a real struggle, and it's gotten a lot better, I think, over the last 20 years. But making sure states are recording all of their disqualifying categories and sending the list of names regularly to the FBI. And having a real national system, because you see every once in a while there'll be a mass shooting and somebody should have been disqualified, you know, and their record just didn't get reported. So closing those gaps are huge. The other thing, and this goes well beyond the book, but there is in most states a loophole, as it were, for private sales. And again, this is not something we talk about in the book, but if you're going to try to prevent certain categories of, and we think it should be limited to really high risk individuals, but if you've successfully identified them, they shouldn't be able to just go to a private seller and be able to acquire a handgun. If they walked into a licensed dealer, they'd be prohibited. Once you've decided they're too risky to have a gun, we should actually try to enforce that. And again, some states have closed that, you know, sometimes called the gun show or private sale loophole. But if you're going to have a background check system, you should be checking the background every time a gun gets transferred.
Is the background check system automatically alerted when someone's subjected to a gun removal order for any particular reason?
So the answer is no, they're not. There's at least a few of the states that adopted red flag laws. And I think this was just oversight and they're probably going back and trying to fix the problem, but actually did not mandate reporting to the background check system. So they'd go and they could, you know, effectively you could remove guns that were currently owned, but the individual could just turn around and go buy more. And so that's something that's just a no-brainer. You have to close that. That really is a true loophole.
What is a gun bounty?
So a gun bounty. So at the end of the book, we talk about trying to incentivize people to come forward with private information. So if you know that your neighbor is a prohibited person, there should be a kind of anonymous, confidential way to report that. And if you want people to have a greater incentive to do it, you could actually reward them for information leading to confiscation of an illegally possessed firearm. So some states and counties are already doing this and providing, you know, $100 for information leading to, you know, retrieval of a gun that was being unlawfully possessed.
Is there any way we could incentivize current gun owners to just disclose the fact that they have firearms? I know some people are really uncomfortable with this because they assume that that will be, you know, that the next step is somebody coming for their guns. Is there a way to get at least some people to sort of make that information available?
You know, I think you could come up with ways of doing this. And I think at certain points, there are public registries of, or have been in the past, registries of concealed carry permits, so that people who've gotten a permit are listed publicly. I don't think I personally favor requiring individuals to self-identify as a gun owner. I do think that could lead to pernicious discrimination. And I think if anything, you know, what we're trying to do is make it possible for people to signal, I'm not a gun owner, right? Which is a harder thing to prove. And we hope that that'll lead to not pernicious discrimination, but positive discrimination, you know, that people with like-minded people can come together and say, look, we're a gun-free neighborhood. And the last, I wanted to mention this on gun-free zones. This is not a big emphasis in the book, but another nice example, I think, of this idea is when people have rallies and demonstrations, they ought to be able to say, look, our rally should be gun-free. And we've seen how, you know, these armed counter-protesters have been showing up at more and more demonstrations and leading to kind of violent confrontation. People are getting shot. People are getting killed. And if you allowed people, when they applied for a permit, to say, no, we want this to be a gun-free demonstration, again, it's another chance for people to associate, to assemble, to exercise their right to be gun-free. And counter-protesters, leave your guns at home.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We have an email here from Melissa who wants to know about the relationship between gun violence and domestic abuse. She wants to know if you've thought about steps that could be taken to improve the safety of victims of domestic abuse. And I suppose she means with regard to domestic abuse that involves the use of guns.
Yeah, so absolutely. That actually was one of the primary motivations for what we've been describing as this unlawful possession petition, a mechanism where someone who's already prohibited from having a gun can have the gun removed. There was an example of a woman who actually got a temporary restraining order against an abusive spouse. He was supposed to give up his guns. He didn't. So she went to the police and said, look, you got to come take away his guns. And they said, nope, sorry, too bad. So she went and herself got the guns, brought them to the police station, and at least initially got charged with armed robbery for removing the guns. Because at the time she was walking away with the guns, she was armed. Right. Even though her husband didn't have a legal right to the guns anymore because it was a domestic violence situation, she had a temporary restraining order that should have prevented gun possession. So making it easier and more effective to get guns out of the hands of domestic abusers is something that we're absolutely, motivated our proposal.
Are there other things that have worked in other countries? I mean, are the gun laws in the U.S. really much laxer than they are in any of the other Western countries that have so many fewer incidents of gun-related violence?
So the short answer is yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, our gun laws are much more relaxed. I think, as to my knowledge, we're the only country with a Second Amendment that's really been interpreted to provide significant protection to an individual's right to bear arms. So the United States is absolutely an outlier among developed countries.
What do you think it will cost to make Donna's Law and red flag laws and other kinds of changes that you've talked about in states and cities around the country? Can a lot of places afford this?
Yeah, so Donna's Law is actually really inexpensive. We already have the federal background check system. States have the option of sending additional names of people who are prohibited under state law. So all you really need is a mechanism for people to sign up and for people to request to have their name removed in the future if they make that decision. So it's just a processing issue. And in fact, in Washington State, the estimated cost of the proposal was so low, it didn't even have to go through the budget committee. So Donna's Law could actually absolutely be done very inexpensively. I mean, a red flag law is a more expensive intervention. It requires, in most places, police involvement. It requires a magistrate or a judge, follow-up hearings if the individual wants to try to get their gun back. So red flag laws are a little more expensive. Donna's Law is very inexpensive.
Frederick E. Vars is the Ira Drayton Pruitt Senior Professor of Law at the University of Alabama, where he specializes in mental health law. His book, Weapon of Choice, Fighting Gun Violence While Respecting Gun Rights, is co-authored by Ian Ayers. Fred, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you get podcasts. Just type KERA Think into the search bar or listen directly from our website. You can stream shows there and find out about upcoming programs we're planning. That is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.